you think life is simpler after you retire? For some, it's actually more complicated when facing issues about health, estate plans, probate, long-term care, and more. That's why attorney CPA Joe Cordell hosts Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors and an open forum for older adults with important questions about their future. Here's attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Welcome to another week of Elder Talk. And we're continuing this week with our guest we had last week. Those of you who listened will recall that Dr. Linda Smith was here, and she's here again this week. She is representative of the Arthritis Foundation, but her experience is so substantial that we knew that she'd be the perfect guest to talk about these issues relating to health, and not just arthritis, but relating to all those joint and vascular and skeletal issues that people have as they age. And those of you who listened last week will know that we talked a lot about diet. We talked a lot about exercise. What I like about Dr. Smith is that she's not real conventional in her thinking. And I'm encouraged that she has had the ear of Washington University School of Medicine. She's spoken to those physicians as well as St. Louis University, the School of Medicine. So she's really had a lot of influence, and she's respected in her field, and yet she's kind of unconventional in many ways, and I think that's a good thing. So we wanted her to come back this week and continue the conversation we had last week. Susan, would you like to fill our audience in on a little more, or have I said it all as introduction?
You actually said most of it, but after last week's show, we were sitting around talking afterwards, and we realized that there was so much in the way of information and research and new research out there that we just didn't even cover. We barely scratched the surface, so we knew we had to have Dr. Smith back. Now, she has been in private practice for 36 years and is the owner of Hands On Health, which is an integrated clinic providing chiropractic care, massage therapy, and acupuncture. Now, as Joe mentioned, she has been affiliated through teaching and research with Logan University, Washington University School of Physical Therapy, and St. Louis University School of Medicine. Welcome.
Thank you.
All right.
It's good to be back.
And, you know, as we were talking last week, we discussed how critical it is that there be exercise, that there be a good diet. And some people have heard this, but they need to understand that these are goals that can be very practical. And I think some people are skeptical about what influence they can have on their health. And maybe it's because of that skepticism that they're not prepared to expend the effort to invest in diet and exercise. Do you want to comment on that?
I think that people are often overwhelmed. They're like, what should I do first? And then they are confused because they hear so much conflicting information. But I think that they can be confident that, as I mentioned before, I'll say it again, I love it, motion is lotion, that movement is good for us, walking is good, dancing is greater, and that nutrition really, really does matter. I remember when I was very, in the early years, someone said to me, oh, it doesn't matter what you eat. A salad is the same as an orange soda and a hot dog. And we have come so far in understanding that what we eat profoundly affects all the functions in our body, including our pain.
And of course, you act as a representative for the Arthritis Foundation. But when I think of all these things that as we age, and our audience for the most part is above age 60, and we know that many of them, they don't feel like getting out and doing these things. And so it was difficult when they were 30. Probably so difficult they didn't do it. And in their 40, they may not have done it. And so here they are. It's even more important that they do it at this stage. And yet they don't feel like it. I mean, how do you solve that circular problem?
Well, one thing I do is tell them to put on some rock and roll. You know, there's just no music like the music of our generation, in my opinion. And it is great to walk to, dance to, hop and skip to. So I say, get up in the morning, make it the first thing you do, put on some great music, and get on out there.
So you're not real patient with their saying, gee, I'm sore, it hurts when I move, I have this pain. And you're saying, look, you just got to grit your teeth and move forward.
Well, I try to be a little gentler than that, but that is the underlying theme, I'd say, and that almost everyone feels better when they get going, when they get moving. And I do think that a lot of times now, not everybody, some people really do move better as the day goes on. And I totally think whatever works for you, but for some people, I'm one of them, as the day gets later and later, many things overtake us and our energy goes down, and then it's harder to get out and exercise.
I think the overwhelming majority of people would say that, that they're more likely to do it early in the day. And I would add, and hopefully you wouldn't disapprove, that what I used to do when I worked out in the morning, and now I do it later in the day, but was I would have coffee, and coffee was a critical component for me. I would drink black coffee, and it just gave me this energy that I was. And the music, I get it completely. I was surprised. I asked someone not long ago who runs marathons. I said, "So do you listen to music in the last few miles?" And he said, "No, nobody listens to music." And I never understood that, because I always, as you said, with the right music playing and headphones, I was good for another few miles.
Can't you hear the Rocky theme song? Dun, 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 dun,
yeah.
Dun, dun,
you know? Yeah, whatever song. And yes, I've run to that incident. I'm old enough. I remember when that was on the top 40. Do they even have a top 40 anymore?
I think it's like the top 400. That's why it's so hard to figure it out.
Yeah. And it's an international list.
Right.
So anyway, but I buy into the argument that music helps. And that you really, however you do it, you've got to do it.
Yes, and coffee, you know, there really are lots of benefits to coffee. They keep trying to find things that are wrong with coffee, but there's a lot right. It's a huge source of antioxidants. They've seen that there may be a decrease in type 2 diabetes with coffee drinkers. So some of us get too edgy with coffee, but there are a lot of health benefits to it. And I'm sure it does help you get up. I'd say coffee and rock and roll.
Well, that's now that needs to go on a prescription pad.
There you go.
So another thing that I want to get to this week is, we talked about solutions that allowed you to avoid pharmacological things, surgical procedures, and things like that. And you talked about how massage really has a therapeutic effect. We've talked about exercise. You talked about the role of diet. But what, in addition to that, I know some people are taking over-the-counter medications. We talked, you know, opioids, of course, is a hot topic right now. And so many people are very conscious of the fact that if they're on these, they need to get off. And I want to jump to the conclusion that most of our audience knows that.
Yes.
But you suggested last time, we didn't have time to discuss it, that in addition to opioids, there are other things that people are taking for pain that are also harmful and they don't know it.
Yes, I think that people think that an over-the-counter medicine, such as a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, such as Aleve, Advil, Motrin, ibuprofen, Naprosyn, Naproxen, these are all over-the-counter anti-inflammatories, and that because they're over-the-counter, that they are safe. But what we have found is that, first of all, they have issues with your gastrointestinal system. They put pressure on the kidneys over time. But what the most disturbing thing is lately is that when you take these non-steroidals, they raise the risk of heart attack pretty much immediately. They found that within the first week of taking this medication. And I think that people need to understand that just because something's over the counter does not mean that it's safe. They need to know their specific heart risks. But I think those of us over 60, many of us are on blood pressure medicine. We've had some kind of heart issues. We know we have cardiovascular disease. And for those of us in that category, taking these non-steroidals is not a benign act.
So do doctors know this? Is this relatively newly discovered?
Well, it's been building. The latest evidence came out in June of this year, June of 2017. There's been a lot of press on it. But I still have patients who come in and they've had this prescription of 1,200 milligrams of Motrin for 10 days or something, and that's a risky prescription. And I'm not sure that, you know, physicians sometimes are in a big hurry. But not only physicians, we just have to say people don't even have to have that. They can just go to the drugstore on their own. So they need to know over-the-counter does not mean safe, and that there are safer choices. And those include hands-on care, chiropractic care, acupuncture, which may seem like a mysterious force, but we can talk about how acupuncture works to help clarify that.
Yeah, we will.
Spinal manipulation, which is what chiropractors do, massage therapy, and also lots of things, Tai Chi, yoga. So there's lots of things that we can do that do not fall into the drug category that would be much safer and really feel great. I think for those of people out there who've never had any of these, they might be surprised at how great they feel.
So, but sorry to interrupt you, Susan, but so you would say then that it's okay to occasionally take these NSAID, that would be the category you mentioned. People see, are these called NSAIDs?
NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories.
Okay.
I actually think it depends on the person's health. So I think that somebody needs to understand that they elevate blood pressure, they raise your risk of stroke, and they raise your risk of heart attack. And because I think what is occasional, some people think that just taking them a couple times a week is occasional. So I think people need to really seriously think about alternatives to taking those medications.
Okay, so when someone has a headache, then what would they...
That's what I was going to ask. So good. Think
See,
the
Susan,
same thing.
You let me interrupt you enough, and I'll eventually ask you a question.
Well, I think you have to know what the headache is coming from. Interestingly, aspirin does not fall into the category of non-steroidals. In fact, aspirin, it is a non-steroidal, but it doesn't raise your risk of heart disease. In fact, it lowers it because it's a blood thinner. And so
this drives me nuts, though. I thought that aspirin for a while was on the outs.
Exactly.
And it was the others that were
ibuprofen. That's why you got to stay with it. Yeah, I know.
Because you were supposed to take Tylenol, then you were supposed to take the ibuprofen. Now you're back to aspirin because that's a better alternative. I can't keep up.
Well, aspirin is risky if you keep taking it over time because it can increase bleeding.
I see.
It can increase bleeding. But I think if I have an occasional headache, I take aspirin. That's what I would take. I think Tylenol has its own risks, but it doesn't have the same risks as non-steroidals. Tylenol is acetaminophen.
And are there things that you can do that are perhaps even still not even necessarily an aspirin or whatever, that you have the headache, you have pain, you're just trying to alleviate the pain at the moment?
What if you smoke marijuana?
I feel that that's out of my area of expertise.
No, I mean, I hear this, that it's supposed to be this pain reliever. And I've always been skeptical because, you know, having grown up.
That wasn't where I was going, but.
So, I was going to ice and meditation myself.
So what were you going to ask, Susan?
Well, that was just, you know, what are some things that you can do? I mean, what if I have a migraine or I have a headache? What are some things that maybe if I want to avoid the drugs, what can I do?
Here's a couple solid recommendations. Number one, ice on the back of the head, right at the back of the head. Like if the person lies down, puts pillows under his knees, puts an ice pack under his neck, you'd be surprised what cooling down the back of the neck can do for headaches.
Really?
Yeah. Also, an eye pillow, a little pillow that you put over the eyes, you can cool that. I'm a huge fan of guided relaxation, meditation programs, and if people have some training in that, they can lie down, put the eye pillow on, maybe take an aspirin and take a rest for 20 minutes in a dark room. That can be very helpful. Now, migraine, you know, you're really in the big category.
Yeah,
that's a whole
you're
subject.
You're debilitated.
That's a debilitating, you know. The other thing is understanding the role of the neck. Sometimes neck issues, poor posture can contribute to headaches. Then there's allergies. So it depends, why did that person get that headache?
Yeah. You know, there are people who say that whenever you have pain at your body telling you something, and that often it may make sense to let that work through because your body is responding to that. Mm-hmm. And maybe the thing that stops the pain is something that really is preventing your body from working through the correction process that it would otherwise have. Is there some truth to that?
Well, if I had a headache that really... Usually if I get a headache, there may be something going on in my neck, and I really love chiropractic care for that, and I think chiropractic care for headaches can be really, really helpful. Spinal adjustments in the neck, deep massage in the neck, those can be tremendously relieving of pain.
Well, let's talk about that then. So how is it that that works? I mean, many people have heard, I've heard about chiropractic care. I know at one time the in medical science community were skeptical And now I know it seems that it has gained a large degree of acceptance among physicians or MDs. Tell me how it works and what the science
is
behind it.
Okay, so let's talk about, if we could just stick with headaches and upper neck pain for a moment. So patients often get that, because they've been in a car accident and they may have a permanent pattern of muscular damage that goes into the back of their neck, for example, a whiplash injury. So there's old injuries that cause that. There's chronic posture, sitting at a desk improperly, leaning forward, using a mouse with one hand repeatedly may create a pattern in the neck. The pattern in the neck involves muscular tension patterns inserting into the joints in the spine. Those will rotate and sort of lock on the person. They may see that it's difficult to turn their head to one side or the other. Spinal manipulation induces motion into those joints and causes a relaxation effect around that area. And patients immediately feel that they can turn their head better, and they'll feel a lot of freedom. They've also seen that that lowers blood pressure. So there's some profound effects that we're still learning to understand, but we do understand the muscular and joint effect. There are muscles at the base of the skull that form trigger points, and I'll push on them when I'm examining someone, and they will reproduce their headache. The headache, that pushing on that spot may shoot pain behind their eye, shoot pain down into their shoulder, and that's one way that I know that that's where that pain is coming from. And I have the choice. I can do deep tissue massage. I can do spinal manipulation in that area. I can use acupuncture needles to go into those trigger points. I have a number of choices. Once I've done that, it's usually a relief immediately. Then I give the patient some things to correct their posture. How are they sitting at their desk? Some stretches that they can do to really get at the problem. So now you see we're not masking the problem. We're really looking at what caused that problem and trying to interrupt
it. And solving it.
Yeah.
And to hopefully prevent it from coming back.
All right. We're going to take a break. We'll be back in a minute with Dr. Linda Smith.
You're listening to Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors. Presented by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. And now, attorney CPA, Joe Cordell.
So we're back. This is Elder Talk with Dr. Linda Smith. Before we went into the break, we were talking about exactly how is it that chiropractic works. Is that a word, chiropractic?
Chiropractic.
Chiropractic works? And you were describing an example where people have headaches. What about how the manipulation of your joints or your spine affect other areas of your body? What's the science of that?
So another example, well, there's a couple things I want to say about that. I just wanted to give another example of how manipulation works. So in the lower spine, it's very common to pinch nerves that may cause some peripheral symptoms going down into the shoulders, sometimes into the arms. This can be a tricky area and you have to be careful, but it is also possible that with careful chiropractic care, we can free up those nerve roots and relieve a lot of pain in the upper back, neck, going down the shoulders into the arms. We combine that often with maybe a collar, some way of holding things still, using ice, again, correcting posture. When someone gets chiropractic care, we usually work the neck, the upper back, the hips. It's a full body care. And when we do that, we release a lot of stress on that system. And things might happen. Sometimes patients' sinuses may open up. Sometimes a lot of stress will be released and their blood pressure will go down. So there'll be some systemic effects that we can't exactly predict, but that are common.
Things that are related in indirect and direct ways,
yes,
to all these other functions that you wouldn't normally associate with your spinal health,
right,
for example.
Right.
Huh. So then in a way, though, there's just some trial and error involved, it sounds like. Is that true?
No, I think it's educated, because usually people come to us 95% of the time. A patient goes to see a chiropractor for back and neck pain. that limits what we really are good at. For example, I'll take care of many frozen shoulders, elbows that have tendonitis in them, hip pain. So there's, foot pain, plantar fasciitis. There's lots of areas that we treat, but the public really knows us for back and neck pain. So understanding how manipulation helps free up joints, helps interrupt muscle spasm, how it works with massage, with good exercise, with posture, I think this is what the public needs to know so they don't have to be confused about what are we doing for them.
So would you suggest then that someone who is otherwise feeling okay, I mean, they have the pains and complaints, we'll assume, of aging when they're 60 plus, but would you think that as a matter of course it would make sense for people to go see a chiropractor on some schedule, maybe once a month or once a week?
I think it depends. That is a broad range, so some chronic pain patients may come in once every couple weeks. I have lots of people that come in once a month. I think it's a wonderful way to take care of your body. I think combining that with a routine of massage, you can help avoid, most people wait until something's really bad.
Right.
And then they head towards medications, or then they feel disabled and depressed, and then they can't get up and get going and do the exercise we talked about. So if you have a good team with your chiropractor, your acupuncturist, your massage therapist, you can get these problems interrupted. So yes, I love that maintenance care, and I love the idea of the public having a team that they can go to when they have these issues.
Does insurance typically pay for chiropractic?
Yes. Yeah, it does.
It seems like so many of the times people need to just maybe readjust their thinking a little bit. I mean, when I have pain, I want relief right away. And I think one of the things that I hear about chiropractic is, well, they just want to keep me going and it takes weeks on end.
Yeah. So I'd like to address that, because in my clinic, the way I practice, I'm aiming to turn that patient around immediately.
Okay.
And I think that that's the benefit of an integrated model, where we don't just use spinal manipulation. We also include massage therapy. We also include acupuncture. We also include physical agents like heat or ultrasound or ice. And so my goal is to turn that pain syndrome, shut it down as quickly as possible.
And that can often happen for some things in one session.
Yep. A lot of things will change in one session. Some things won't. You have to be realistic. That's what we try to talk to people about. And a lot of times it comes back to self-care.
Yeah.
So it comes back to self-care, that patients need to be willing to do the work that we want them to do.
Huh. Well, now distinguish between that and acupuncture. How does acupuncture work?
So there are two areas of acupuncture that I'd like to talk about. One is sort of the really old historical model of moving energy through the body, which is very hard for people to get a grip on. It's very Eastern thinking. Then there's also dry needling, which is a much more westernized approach. I'll say something about that first. So, for example, a patient with severe hip pain and some arthritis, an interesting thing, that patient in the medical model would often get a cortisone shot in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the research they're doing now shows that that cortisone may or may not help, but the needling of that tissue helps.
Hmm.
So the question is, well, do we need to put the medicine in there, or could we do it without the medicine? And using these very thin, fairly long, about 2-inch long needles, we can needle into the area of pain, which is an area of balled up muscle tissue that has proliferated extra nerve fibers and forms what we call a trigger point. Trigger points can be in ligaments, they can be in muscles. And when we put the needle right into the center of that area and we connect electric stim, we disorganize the tissue that has been balled up in a painful knot. When we combine that with deep massage, exercise, now let's say we take that arthritic hip and put it in the water, nice warm water, they're walking in the water, that combination can be really, really helpful. And now we've used no medication of any kind.
That sounds painful.
Okay, that's a good point. So it's, if you could see the needle, it's like almost as thin as your hair.
Yeah.
And so it's way different than the needle that they use with cortisone in it. It's a very, you feel a little ache, but it's almost like a good ache. You're like, yes, they found the spot. People want me to find their pain.
Yeah. And I've actually had that done, and you're right. It really does sound bad, but it's not. At least what I had done. Interestingly, I was referred to an acupuncturist by a prominent neurosurgeon at Washington University School of Medicine. And the idea, as I understood it with this person, and this related to an arm with like tennis elbow or whatnot, mm-hmm. was that it would trigger the body to send to this area all these, for lack of knowing the terms, these healing forces that
good chemicals.
It's really, yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, that gets sent to a site where there's been some sort of trauma,
right?
And so it speeds up or creates a healing process that wouldn't otherwise be triggered.
I think that that's great, and I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think that an important thing to add is that these areas of injury, whether it's the headache at the back of the neck, the pain behind the shoulder blade that drives people crazy, the acute low back pain, what happens in those muscles is they get congested too. It's almost like they lose their normal blood supply in that area. And the needling, the dry needling, the deep tissue massage, the manipulation stimulates proper circulation in that area. And that's very, very helpful.
And is this gaining more acceptance, acupuncture?
Oh, yes. And this year, one of my colleagues at Logan University was part of a study with Harvard. They've been working together for a number of years. So there's a wonderful linking of two great institutions. And they mapped the brain while patients received acupuncture for carpal tunnel. Just to remind your listeners, that's in the wrist, and it's one of the most common neuropathies in the wrist, causing people lots and lots of pain, and surgery's been a very common solution. And so they map the brain to see what happens in the brain when they're doing this treatment. And they compared it to sham acupuncture, and they also did acupuncture in the opposite lower leg, which I think is just fascinating. What they found was the wrist worked the best, the leg worked some, it did work, it did help. And the sham acupuncture also helped a little bit, probably a placebo effect. But there was significant improvement in the real acupuncture, and they saw changes in the brain. The brain went back to normal. It actually rewired the somatosensory cortex in the brain, which is just so interesting to find out how this acupuncture is working. So the idea is that it works at the local level, and it also works through the central nervous system.
So this is, and I could see how there's this search right now for alternatives to traditional surgery and pharmacology, because I think that we just can't afford, in part, it's a societal economic question. But apart from that, it's a matter of resources, people that are skilled to do these things.
I think so. And I think what we need, the word I love to say is safer pain solutions. We need safer pain management choices for people. And we need to expand the toolbox. The course I taught at St. Louis University School of Medicine was called Expanding Your Toolbox. And I think we need to broaden the toolbox of the way we approach the human body.
Well, and I think the general public needs to have still an even greater shift toward these things if they're going to be successful. I mean, what I find in talking to people is chiropractic or some of these alternative treatments are good, but when it really gets sick, I'll go see a surgeon, or I'll go see, you know, we forget about the scar tissue in carpal tunnel or those types of things. And so I think you're right when you said earlier that people are still thinking back issues. I think they forget that chiropractic and alternative treatments are for
right.
other parts of the body. And I don't know.
Oh,
what
I
needs
totally.
To change
yeah.
On that,
well, but I think one thing is that sometimes the word, just the phrase alternative, is very scary to people.
Mm-hmm.
And so
mm-hmm.
if we say conservative, which I think it is, these are conservative approaches. They are safer, conservative, less expensive, with basically no side effects. And if we can communicate to the public and also between the physician, the medical physician, and the chiropractic physician, so that we mm-hmm. communicate, because sometimes somebody needs surgery. We all, you know, that we need all these things. We just need to use them more judiciously.
Yeah, and I think that surely people are coming to realize that you know, through some fundamental changes in terms of their diet and exercise, they can prevent, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say 90%+ of the problems that they have with their health.
Right.
And it's just hard to, I don't know if it's hard to sell that message or if people are listening to the message, believing it and saying, I'm just not prepared to pay that price.
I think it's too long term. I think we're in an instant gratification society, and I don't think we want to.
Well, you know, I just want to say something about that, because on the subject of heart disease, there's been some studies that have shown that when people change their lifestyle, they change their diet, they change their exercise, they have some kind of stress management, like a meditation or something, that within 1 week, their blood pressure, many of their indicators will change. Hmm. So I think that people underestimate how dramatically they can impact their lives.
I think that is a large part of it, is mm-hmm. that people have heard these sort of maxims since they were kids, that you know, eat your vegetables. And it's become, you know, this sort of meaningless chant to them that they think it isn't where the real action is. The real action is with, you know, a drug or a medical procedure. And in part, our medical profession has taught that, and they dispense this information in this godlike dependence that people have on them, and I don't know if it's conscious or unconscious, but it certainly has accrued to their benefit so far. But I think that the reality is, if we can tell people what you said last week and this week, and I want to circle back to this, though we talked about it briefly last week. I think we talked about all this confusion when we think diet. I mean, let's assume our audience is persuaded that diet's important. Let's assume we've succeeded in that. If they've listened to this show very long, they've heard it a bunch of times by a bunch of different people.
They have no choice now. They have to go with it.
So let's hope there's some buy-in on that. And you talked last week about, you know, how grains can sometimes not be healthy. Mm-hmm. And yet there's such contradictory positions taken among very authoritative people. And I'll take one for example. Some of our audience, I know, listen to Colin Campbell, and they've perhaps been a fan of his, and he's been very prominent. He wrote the China Study, and he regularly appears with people like S. Esselstyn, who was the surgeon that represented President Clinton. Many people are familiar with this doctor who treated him, and he's written some books, and Esselstyn, I think, is his name. And I could name a few others, and they're of the school that says that, you know, minimize or eliminate meat and all whole plants. They'd say whole plants, but they would include grains. You know, they would say, I know Colin Campbell has spoken very appreciatively of the nutritional value of grains and legumes. Legumes are like bean type mm-hmm, things related mm-hmm, to beans, mm-hmm. Including peanuts, right, would be a legume. Mm-hmm. So, but yet you have this other group of authorities whose name I can't rattle off as well, but there are people who've subscribed to what's been called generally kind of the paleo diet.
Right.
And the paleo diet, of which I think you seemed when we talked last week to be somewhat of an advocate of that. Mm-hmm. Correct me if I'm wrong. But anyway, so the paleo generally is meat is okay, even within reason. Some would say more than others, but whether it's more, whether it's less, meat is okay. And vegetables and fruits are good. So they agree with the, you know, with the Colin Campbell vegan group on that. But then they would say, you know, the grains and the legumes are kind of recent developments. They're new to the human species, mm-hmm. and they may have come along in very recently, depending on the age of man. So our bodies aren't equipped to deal as well with it, and that's the reason we have lots of these problems that we can't quite figure out where they're coming from, whether it's allergies or sinus issues or skin issues and other things that they would say have, and worse things, have their roots in grain consumption. So for them, grain is the evil.
It's confusing.
And dairy too. Dairy is something that came along much later as a agricultural after the agricultural revolution. We got grains, we got dairy, and we got legumes. And I think that many paleos would say grains are worst, most harmful generally to the body. Then they would say secondarily maybe dairy, and then third, because some think legumes are okay, some don't. So that's optional for some paleos. But so there's this civil war between these two basic schools, and they agree on some things. They agree on fruits and vegetables are good. So there's that we can go to. But otherwise, if you're even a very intelligent reader on this subject, and I consider myself a reader on this subject, I sometimes throw my hands up.
So I'd love to comment on all this.
Please. That was a long introduction, but I wanted the audience
to
appreciate.
Lay the groundwork, yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So first of all, I can't say that I fall into any category. I would like to say that I do not fall into any category except the following. If we said tons and tons of fresh fruits, okay, fruits that you don't normally eat. We talked about that last time, the rainbow.
Right.
Tons and tons of vegetables, eating the rainbow of vegetables, finding nutrition that you have not had lately. I do believe in grains. I think we mainly are like a wheat-based society. It does seem that wheat definitely causes problems. Mm-hmm. And so again, I would refer readers to listeners to lots of different kind of grains, ancient grains that maybe haven't been part of your diet. Look for those and how you can cook them. I think quinoa is a good example, barley, bulgur. Now, this issue of meat versus no meat, I've actually just gone through the Dean Ornish program with my husband, who had heart disease this year. So
okay.
I do, I'm very familiar with the totally vegan, no fat approach.
Yeah, Dean Ornish is a big proponent of that. Yeah.
Yes, he is. And it makes me quite uncomfortable, the whole idea. I do believe that this whole idea that there are good fats, we need fats for our brain, we need avocados, and we need walnuts, and we need olive oil, so that there are the good fats. I think that is pretty solid and delicious. And there are lots of nuts that are great, pumpkin seeds, hazelnuts. Again, things that we don't normally think of. I think peanuts are a problem only for some people, but they probably wouldn't be my favorite one. The other thing that's interesting, and I have been listening to this, is about what about organ meats? Like what's in a clam? What's in a scallop, or not the mollusks, and that they have very concentrated nutrition. And I didn't really know that. I just learned that. So I think a number of things. One size does not fit all. People need to be sensitive to their own bodies. I don't think there's going to be one answer. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Number two, nutrition is an evolving science. Finally, we're paying attention. Really, almost everyone is now paying attention. The cardiologist that my husband worked with, the other hospital, they are really paying attention now. That's a huge step in the right direction. I think people need to understand that it's going to be changing all the time. But if everybody had lots of fruits and vegetables, watched their saturated fats, had cold water fish like salmon, freshwater fish like trout right here in Missouri, lots of delicious fresh trout. Stayed away, we can all agree. Sugar.
Yeah.
In the handout they gave my husband, they said, sugar is like shards of glass in your arteries. I can't get over that picture.
That should be graphic enough to get your attention.
So I think we could agree on, there's so many things we can
agree on. Yeah.
That would make the whole population so much healthier. Right
yeah,
there.
All the experts, you're right. All the experts agree on that about sugar.
And white flour, your white refined,
yes.
That refined products. So I would just go with, what do we all agree on? And then the rest be watching it as an evolving story.
I hear so much about inflammation, speaking of the arthritis.
Yeah.
And
I'm glad you came
inflammation.
Back to that. Yep.
And I mean, obviously sugar and white flour here are two big bad things, but yeah. What other things might cause inflammation?
So regular beef that is grain-fed beef, I would caution our listeners, to look for grass-fed beef. And I think that can be a source of inflammation.
Meaning if it's not grass-fed.
If it's not grass-fed, yeah, exactly. Your wheat, all your wheat and gluten products can be inflammatory. And the you can do your own test. Just get rid of all your gluten products for 3 weeks. And then after 3 weeks, eat something gluten like bread 3 times a day for a couple days. And watch your joints and see if they feel better. Or feel worse once you start back on the gluten product.
Yeah.
That's a very inexpensive, very accurate, that's a very accurate way to figure it out.
Yeah, and in fact, a friend of mine who teaches at WashU School of Medicine, he did his own experiment with glutens or grains, and I'll make that distinction here in a second for people who are listening, but he's convinced that his skin reacted when he was eating. Maybe it was just glutens, but I think mm-hmm. it was grains, mm-hmm. meaning grains that were non-gluten, but yet they would have, you know, been in that category. And so he would notice that he had this vulnerability to eczema, and he said or psoriasis, but he said it would break out, and he would notice clearly it was worse when he was eating grains. So he's minimizing grains. And so what on that subject, going back a minute, some people listening are thinking, well, what I really meant was gluten-free, but for paleos, as you know, Dr. Smith, is that they generally don't stop at glutens. I mean, they
right.
say
they're
grains.
Trying to cut down on carbohydrates.
Yeah, yeah, and grains generally as
yes,
a category.
Yeah, right, and fruits. They don't want to eat a lot of fruits either
some
because they think that it's too high in sugar.
Yeah, you're right. And they would say berries are great, but they would say there's a lot of bad fruits where not much nutritional value.
I don't know if I can back that one up.
Yeah, yeah, no. And it's a dispute that goes on. And as you pointed out, clearly there's not one single answer for everybody.
I think this is going to be the medicine of the future is going to be personalized medicine, that your system is not the same as my system, it's not the same as your system, Susan, and that we are going to need physicians and healthcare providers who can help us figure out our path. We do all these randomized controlled studies where you look at an entire population of people, and I think those are very valuable, especially for testing drugs. But when it comes to lifestyle and nutritional choices, there may be things that I can eat that are going to be a problem for you. And so I think all these diets have a place, but one diet is not going to win.
Yeah, you're right. And as you said, there are common denominators we know that will be true for all humans. Lots of nutrition. So
lots of exercise.
Yeah, veggies, mm-hmm. exercise. We know all those things will be important. But there will be people who I'm sure can eat grains and will not have any skin response at all. They'll not have the joint issues. Their body's fine with it. For that matter, there are people who I grew up in southeastern Kentucky in Appalachia, and there are people that were 90 in their 90s smoking, and so
we're not going to follow them though.
We know our bodies have these.
There are genetic. You know what? We're not going to control all of it. We're just not. We're not going to control. Our genes are going to be heavy hitters.
Yeah.
There are people that can eat way more than I do and that are tall and thin, and I'm going to be short and not so thin. You know, depending on what...
That falls into the life is not fair category.
Exactly. You know, it's one of those, they're eating sugar all the time. And so you're right. We're all different. I mean, I've even heard of blood type diets, depending on what your blood type is.
But I think to bring it back, that the idea that we can be agents of our own health is just a really important. We can be agents of our own health. It doesn't have to be boring. It can be fun.
Yeah.
It can be delicious. You can dance and skip, as we talked last time. Those are wonderful for your bone density. You can play music. So try to bring some joy into your health program. That would be another thing I would say.
It can be a hobby, right?
Yeah.
Where you enjoy. And while we don't yet have the ability to get the personalized information our genes will probably give us in 5 to 10 years. We do have the ability to eat things, as you said, and to know. I mean, we can conduct our own experiments.
We can conduct our own experiments.
And see if glutens are causing us problems. But it's a matter of being very intentional about it.
Intentional, and I would add the word adventurous. Because sometimes I think this category, it's like people are like, oh, nutrition, mm-hmm. oh, how that's right. so boring. But if you say, I'm going to be an adventurous, intentional eater, I'm going to find out what's good for my body. I'm going to find some new foods that I haven't had before. And I'm going to take care of myself and have fun along the way.
Yeah. So you're a big proponent of dance.
Oh, I am.
You think balance is a piece that is sometimes neglected in exercise programs?
Well, so that would bring me to a really important area, which is just women as we age. And if you'll notice, if you think about maybe people that you know, women in their 80s, often they don't want to drive at night. They don't want to go out at night because their vision has changed. Mm-hmm. Their balance has changed. They may get unsteady when they're walking. These are things that we can fight as we age. And we women have unique issues. Our bones tend to thin more easily than men. And our balance, if our balance is good, it doesn't matter if our bones are a little bit thinner. But our balance, so dancing causes the brain to work in more complicated ways. And the bones are like, whoa, we're doing something complicated. I need calcium. I'm going to pull calcium into my bones. I'm going to strengthen them up. So it's very fascinating the way that bones work and what they respond to. So I would encourage all listeners, and dancing, you know, we forget about dancing, right? We forget about it sometimes.
So this dancing, is it important that we be doing things that, for lack of a better word, are more of an impact, high impact or heavier impact?
It could be, but it turns out that, I mean, if you're just up on your feet and you're dancing, I'm happy with any kind of dancing, you know, ballroom, jazzercise, anything that people want to do.
But it doesn't have to necessarily be weight-bearing. Or it should be weight-bearing. I mean,
swimming.
Well,
it's going to
be weight-bearing.
But swimming? I mean, what about
swimming?
Well, but
that's not as good for the bones, though, is it?
No. Swimming is not as good
for
the bones.
So you need a mixture.
What about, and we're about almost out of time, what about Tai Chi?
Okay, so they've done some really great studies on Tai Chi. And Tai Chi helps with pain management. It helps with balance. It helps with concentration. We didn't cover that, but pain, chronic pain can be brought under control or can be helped with some kind of meditation because we're calming down the nervous system. And the Tai Chi is one of those moving meditations.
Huh. So Tai Chi, I would like to have you, maybe next time you're on, we'll have you talk a little more about that, because I think that's something that all of our audience can do. In addition to dancing,
yes.
Some will
yep.
be more inclined to go dancing or to be in a dance class, and others might be more attracted to this Tai Chi alternative. I know a lot of older people that we saw recently have been fans of this. And let me mention also, we were in China. We're almost out of time. We were in China about 10 years ago, and I remember asking our guide, we would see older people standing in these parks, and there would be rows of them. There may be 40, 50, 100 in these parks throughout the city on every morning when we're driving around, whatever city we're in. And we finally asked the tour guide, we said, what are they doing? He said, oh, they're doing Tai Chi. Mm-hmm. They all come out, and this is a ritual in China. In the mornings, the older people, and they looked like the most of them were older, or over, say, 60, and they all get out there and stand, and they do Tai Chi. And they look pretty mobile to me.
You know, we talked last time about the blue zones and how people live in these blue zones an older age. I think this is something that we can learn from the East. This Tai Chi, and they've been looking at it, the way it calms down pain and the way people move in a slow way is not traumatic. And I think it's a wonderful choice for your older population.
A wonderful point to close with. Boy, Susan, every time we have Dr. Smith on, we always run out of time.
We do.
And we'd like to talk more. We promise those of you listening, we will definitely have Dr. Linda Smith back. And we'll talk about additional issues. And that's the thing about about you, Dr. Smith, as a guest is that we can talk about any aspect of health, and you have an opinion, you have knowledge of it, you are an authority to some extent on it, and that's the way health should be, holistic. So with that, we'll wrap up. Thank you, and we look forward to having those of you listening back next week with Elder Talk.
You've been listening to Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors with attorney CPA Joe Cordell. Listen again next Saturday for another edition of Elder Talk, sponsored by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. For more information, visit eldercarelaw.com. That's eldercarelaw.com. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely on advertisements.